You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast. Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Podcast, episode 49. I'm Chris Webster.
And I'm April Camp Whitaker. On today's show, we talk to Dr. Elizabeth Sachuk about a 5,000-year-old burial monument found in Kenya.
Let's dig a little deeper. Welcome to the show, everyone. As I mentioned, today we have Dr. Elizabeth Sachuk on the show. She is the lead bioarchaeologist for the Later Prehistory of West Turkana project. She received her PhD in anthropology from the University of Toronto in 2017 and is currently a postdoctoral fellow at Stony Brook University in New York and an affiliated researcher with the Max Planck Institute for the Science of Human History in Jena, Germany. She has been excavating sites in Kenya and Tanzania since 2010 and specializes in bioarchaeology, dental morphology, and population relationships, and mortuary archaeology. Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So we first heard about you because of an article that was found, our producer actually found this, published on August 23rd, 2018 from CNN. This is where we at least came across the article, and we'll link to this in the show notes for anyone that wants to see that. But the article is titled Massive 5,000-Year-Old Burial Monument Unearthed in Kenya. Why don't you tell us a little bit about where that is in Kenya and what's going on right there? And keep in mind, we have a general audience. So if you use any dating terms or anything like that, let's try to give the dates and so people can understand what's going on here. So tell us a little bit about this site in Kenya.
Will do. So the CNN article is based on a academic paper we recently just published, my team and I, in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. It came out around August 20th. And the article talks about some research that we've been doing in northern Kenya since 2009, but really excavations were between 2012 and 2014 on this site called Lothigam North. So the site is one of six monumental sites around Lake Turkana, which is in northwestern Kenya. It's the fourth largest of the African Great Lakes. And by monumental, I mean that these sites have these arrangements of these stone pillars, these big stone pillars that people would have had to drag from at least a kilometer away and put in these sites. And so they kind of look like these little Stonehenges in the Turkana Desert, for lack of a better comparator. And so our research, we are very interested in what these sites were used for. There had been some discussion starting in the 1970s when archaeologists became aware of these. They're in a very remote area, that they might be cemeteries because it looks like the stones are perhaps grave markers that we would understand in a Western context. However, there'd never been any excavation at these sites. The local Turkana people have been, of course, living around the area for hundreds of years. In their own oral legend, they came from Uganda about 300 years ago, so they don't identify as the descendants of the people who made these sites, but they see themselves as kind of guardians of these sites. And that's because in their folklore, they believe that the pillars were dancers that were turned to stone by an angry god who came down to one of their parties and he was dressed in ridiculous clothing and all the people started laughing at him. And so, of course, deities don't fancy being made fun of. So he turned all the people to stone. So the Turkana recognize these people as the old occupants of the Turkana Basin, and they treat them with respect. They'll often put a stone on the pillars as they pass by as just an acknowledgement of their humanity. So, of course, it's very important that we work with Turkana communities as we've been researching these sites, as we've been doing. But what we found and what we've published in this article is that these are, in fact, cemeteries. And not only are they cemeteries, but they're the largest cemeteries known in Eastern Africa right now. And they're about 5,000 years old. And Lothigam North in particular, using an array of different methods, excavation, something called ground penetrating radar, among others, we've determined that there's probably at least 580 people buried at the site and potentially as many as 1,000. So this is quite an astounding discovery. We had really no idea that we would be finding something on this scale, and there are no precedents anywhere else in Eastern Africa.
What's the nature of the cemetery? When most of our listeners think of cemetery, they probably think of, you know, nice even rows and people buried 6 feet deep. So what's the nature of the cemetery? How is it laid out? How are they buried?
It's completely different than the 6 feet deep orderly rows, that's for sure. So, usually when we think about cemeteries, even in a prehistoric or archaeological context, we always think of them kind of accumulating over time. Think about, you know, a small town where people die and eventually it becomes a cemetery. In this situation, it was completely different. And this is really what that ground penetrating radar told us, as well as our excavation, that right from the beginning of it, people envisioned the final product of this cemetery. And they did that by digging out this huge area, about a 30 meter across platform. They dug it down to over a meter deep, and they did this by removing the Holocene beach sands that would have been accumulating by the edge of the lake. Remember that they had no buckets that we know of. They had no excavator. They had no backhoe. They didn't even at this point probably have animals that were helping them with this. And we don't know that for sure, but modern pastos, for example, in this area don't use any animals to haul. So this was probably a human endeavor where they dug out this large platform. We estimate about 700 meters squared of sediment to create this big hole. And then what they did was they shored up the sides of the hole with these flat sandstone rocks that they brought in, kind of a retaining wall, if you will. And then at the bottom of this hole, the first thing they did was dig these pits, these sandstone pits, in which they put the first burials. And the burials are in all different directions. The people are laid out on their side, on their left side, on their right side, on their stomach, on their back, usually in a flexed position with their arms and legs very tightly in them so they can fit into a smaller hole. And then over time, as more people died, they began placing people over top of these pits, facing north, facing east, facing south, facing west, all different directions and body positions, almost as though to maximize the number of people who could fit in the mortuary cavity. Think about like the Tetris approach to a cemetery, if you will, with respect,
that's,
of course.
That's an interesting image.
But they wanted to really make sure that they could fit in as many people as they could. And what's really interesting about this too, especially from a bioarchaeological point of view, for me excavating the skeletons, is that they didn't accidentally chop off any parts of anyone else. So whatever the situation was, either the burials were accumulating quickly or they marked them in some way, and we think it was probably a combination of both, they remembered where the last person was, and so they could put the next person in a way that didn't intrude on that older burial. So everybody was very much intact, and everybody was is very snuggled up close to one another, facing all different directions and in all different positions, really just in this communal mortuary situation that I've really never seen anything like it before. And what's really interesting as well is that within this, there's old people, there's babies, there's neonates, there's men, there's women, there's children, there's teenagers. Of course, we know this by looking at the indications of the skeletons, but it just really looks like most members of this community are there together kind of forever in this mortuary capacity. So when we think about a Western cemetery where people are orderly laid out and accumulate over time, instead, this looks like this community decided from the very beginning that they were going to create this space where many members of their community, if not all members of their community, could be interred together in what we think was this really powerful display of the strength of their community.
What is the length of time from the earliest burials to the latest burials that this was used, or have you determined that yet?
So that's a great question. One of the issues that we face excavating in northwestern Kenya in the Turkana Desert is that it is a desert. And so the skeletons do not have collagen preserved in them. And this makes it very difficult to directly date the skeletons in a way that we would like. We'd like to date the people at the bottom. We'd like to date the people at the top. Unfortunately, that continues to elude us. What we do have is a bunch of associated radiocarbon dates on other material, notably the ostrich eggshell beads from the site, unmodified ostrich eggshell, as well as charcoal. And so these dates from various points in the platform, as well as in the stone circles that are close to the site, kind of tell us that the site was in use between calibrated about 5,200 years ago and 4,200 years ago. So kind of the minimum amount of time looking at the radiocarbon overlap, because of course there's an error range associated with these dates. The minimum amount of time is about 450 years, and the maximum amount of time is about 900 years. And we don't know if that 450 years actually reflects when all the burials went in or when people were just visiting the site, using the site, leaving behind traces of that time period. So the short answer is we're not quite sure. The longer mm-hmm. answer is we do think that this was about a 450 to 900 period of time where people were intensively using these sites. And then afterwards, they decided to cap the sites. So they weren't abandoned in any way. What happened, what we can tell from our excavations, is that prior to this cavity being filled up to the very top, so before it had reached the level of the ground surface, they decided that it was finished. And what they did was people brought in additional sediment and they created a mound, a platform, a stone platform that was slightly mounded up over the entire area. So this is about 50 to 60 centimeters of fill. And in this fill, you see the odd, the finger or the toe or maybe some artifacts that have kind of worked their way up through various processes. But very much that's the end of the archaeological burial deposits. And then the last thing that they would have done after they created this mound, they brought in a bunch of little black desert varnished pebbles to create this uniform kind of shiny surface. It's very beautiful to walk on. And then the last thing they did was they dragged these pillars from up over the hill and put them at the site. So although the pillars have been the focus of our contemporary curiosity in the site, they're in fact, they're the headpiece. They're the final touch of the site. They would have been brought in last.
So I'm fascinated by the length of time, even the estimated length of time that the cemetery was in use. Because I mean, in grad school, I worked on a cemetery for our shallow geophysics class at the University of Georgia. That was less than, I think, 100 years, maybe 120 years old. And it was total chaos. Mm-hmm. Like people were all over the place. The plan of where everybody was forgotten. That's why our shallow geophysics class was there. You know, every time the university encroached on it a little bit, they kind of cut into the embankments and kind of more people had to be relocated and mm-hmm. and replaced and put other places. And I am amazed that amount of time ago, that kind of knowledge was passed down culturally as to where people were and what the whole plan was. Have you found any, I guess, supporting artifacts? I don't know if documentation would have been a thing 5,000 years ago, but, you know, maybe some sort of rock art that shows the plan or something. Have you found anything else besides the cemetery that says, yes, this was being massively organized? Or is it possible that it was just passed down generation to generation that, hey, this is what our plan is. Could you keep doing this, you know, when I'm dead? And put and bury me over there in grid 5A.
In grid 5A. I think against all odds, it really seems to us, based on all the evidence we've amassed, that it's the latter. We found no evidence of any kind of written language, which is not unusual for this time period and this place. We haven't. Mm-hmm. There is some rock art on some later sites. We don't know if it's associated. And one thing that also perturbs us, in addition to the harsh biomolecular situation in the Turkana Desert, is that we haven't found the habitation sites for these people. There's one on the east side of the lake, Dangodien, which is a site that was excavated in the 1970s, 80s. But other than that, we have spent a lot of time and grant money searching for these habitation sites for the everyday of these people that we think would tell us a lot more about how they survived, what they ate, what the quotidian aspects of their life looked like. But probably through a combination of erosion, because of course this landscape has changed a lot since the lake receded. That's part of what we're looking at in this paper and in this research. And secondly, just because these habitation sites may have been pretty ephemeral if they're very mobile pastoralists moving around, only staying in one place for maybe a few weeks or a few months or a few days at a time, we just haven't been able to find those sites where maybe records would be kept or artifacts would have been there to kind of show us those kind of plans. What we have to remember these people by are their amazing ritual sites. So that's really a blessing and a curse, because we see the most amazing, in many ways, elements of this culture, their beautiful groundstone beads, their perforated hippo tusks, their headpieces made out of, you know, hundreds of gerbil teeth. These things that they wanted to put in their cemetery. But of course, we don't necessarily think that that guy was walking around with this gerbil headpiece on the day to day, or that mm-hmm. the hippos and the elephants and those kind of charismatic megafauna we find in the cemetery reflect what they were eating on a weekday night. So it's a little bit hard to interpret this culture because we're looking at it through the lens of, you know, what would be something like a Sistine Chapel. You know what I mean? an elaborate right. site that a community would have used for many generations. So in the absence of that, what we can tell you from the cemetery sites is that the material culture at the sites is pretty consistent over time, at least at Lothigam North. We see the same kind of pottery being made. We see the same kind of stone tools. And so we think that this was really a cohesive culture where it is conceivable that these people were passing down these instructions through generations, through their oral history, and that this was kind of a focal part of the landscape for several hundred years.
It's actually fascinating. So you've mentioned kind of this concept of pastoralism. I mean, are you guys, several portions to this question. First, can you kind of describe for our listeners what we mean by pastoralism? Because it's not really a term that we're very familiar with in the continental United States and in a lot of modern cultures. You know, there are still pastoralist societies and cultures, but we're often not engaging with them. And then can you just tell us a little bit more about what we do know about how sort of daily society and life was functioning? I mean, are you guys using some kind of ethnographic comparisons to think about, you know, this pastoralist lifestyle, things like that?
Absolutely. So pastoralism is a way of life for people who depend on managing animals or managing livestock. And many pastoral societies are quite mobile because in certain environments, East Africa would be a great example, where you have semi-arid landscapes, unpredictable rainfall, and shifting resources, it doesn't make sense, like in many places of continental U.S. And Canada, where I am right now, to settle down and plant crops because you don't know if the rains are going to come. It's a desert situation, so you don't have that much water at the from the outset. Of course, mass irrigation isn't really an opportunity here. And so what it actually makes more sense is instead of you bringing resources to support your plants and grow them in one place, it makes more sense for you to move around your resources to areas that have rainfall and have this lush grassland. And so what in fact we see is this way of life entering Eastern Africa right at the onset of these sites 5,000 years ago, where people are bringing in cows, sheep, and goat for the first time ever, and they're starting to live this new way of life. And this has been a big question for the pillar sites for some time, because this is a period of big change. We see this economic transition to the first food production, which is mobile pastoralism. We also see these big environmental changes in which Lake Turkana is dropping by about 50% at the end of what we call the African humid period. And so what this creates is a situation in which the old way of life, which is fishing around the lake, we see many sites of people intensively fishing around Lake Turkana, that kind of goes away a little bit because the lake is dropping, it's receding, it's changing. And so some of those deep water fishing habitats we think are no longer really viable. Now, at the same time, livestock comes in and that area where the lake has dropped is suddenly a green pasture land because it's been sitting under the lake for a long time. The environment is changing. So all of a sudden, at the same time that people kind of lose the old way of life, they gain a new way of life. And we think that this kind of complicated environmental, economic, and then social transformation is what really led to the pillar sites and people coming together in new ways and creating new ways of life. Now, to answer your question about comparators for these pastoralists, we have been looking quite a bit into the ethnographic records of contemporary East African pastoralists, which are some of the best documented pastoralists in the world. They move around these semi-arid landscapes. They're incredibly heavily dependent on cattle, sheep, and goats. And it's really part of their culture and their cosmology. So think about iconic groups like the Maasai, where, for example, the Turkana people that live around Lothigam North today are heavy pastoralists. They have the majority of their subsistence come from the products of pastoralism. And it's really their identity. It's their culture. Their animals are engaged in elaborate networks of family and marriage and reciprocity and wealth. And it's really important for them to live with their animals and move around, continuing this traditional way of life. But one thing that we're realizing is that the pastoralists living in Eastern Africa today are not quite the same as these first pastoralists that came through the Turkana Basin to enter Eastern Africa. And that's because at that one habitation site that I mentioned, Dongodian, as well as some other indications from around the basin, we see evidence that people are doing more of a mixed economy of both pastoralism and fishing. So we definitely find the remains of fish bones in that habitation site. as well as around the lake, indications that people are still fishing. But we also see the beginnings of herding cattle and goats, and potentially also sheep. And so it really looks like in this period of this big change and these first pastoralists, they're not quite fully blown pastoralists yet. They're kind of figuring things out. And that's probably for the reasons that I mentioned, that the environment is changing really rapidly, that the livestock have come in while the fishing diminishes. And then the third thing, too, is we assume when whoever brought livestock into the Turkana Basin arrived, it wasn't empty. There were fishers living around the lake, probably grappling with their own changes. So we also assume, although it's difficult to see this evidence in the archaeological record, we assume that there was lots of cultural contact at this time, too, between different people. And this was kind of the birth of East African pastoralism. These events are in some way linked to why you see a Maasai warrior greeting you at the Nairobi airport in 2018.
Okay, well, that is a great place to take a break. And we have some follow-up questions for that information you just presented here after the break. And we'll do that in a second. Back in a minute.
This network is listener-supported. We're trying to move away from paid advertising while also creating new shows and supporting the ones we have. The APN has never and will never make a serious profit on our podcast. Every little dime we make goes back into the network and improving show quality. So become a member today at www.arcpodnet.com/members to show your support, get some extras, and be a benefactor for archaeological education. Members get stickers, a coffee mug, a t-shirt, bonus content, early access to episodes, a private Slack team to talk to other members and the hosts, and full access to training on Team Black over at arccert.black. So check out our memberships at www.arcpodnet.com/members today and support archaeological education. That's www.arcpodnet.com/members. Now back to the show.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to episode 49. We are talking with Dr. Elizabeth Shatuk about her research on early cultures in Kenya and Tanzania. And so coming back to our conversation that we left off of, we were just talking about kind of pastoralism and the culture and societal structure of the group that she's been studying. So coming off of that, thinking about the mobility of these groups, because it sounds, you know, early pastoralism, it sounds like they're partially mobile, but a little bit potentially semi-stationary, living in one location for periods of time. Do you think that this site is in some ways acting as a congregation point for people, for these semi-mobile groups to kind of come back and recongregate and have sort of a central place?
Absolutely. That is precisely what we're arguing in the paper, because although these people may have been in some areas for maybe, a few days, a few weeks at a time, ultimately those pastures then would be exhausted by herding animals. Same with local fishing spots. You know, it may have been beneficial to move around. And also within this schema, you don't want to have too big a group. You don't want to be moving around with dozens of people, because for every person you have X number of animals, and you know, exponentially the grass begins to be depleted faster. So mobile pastoralists very much move around in kind of family bands or groups, kind of smaller organizations. And then they come together at various points to kind of meet, to exchange information, to exchange animals, which is really important to maintain the genetic diversity and health of a herd. And then also, in wonderful human ways, also to exchange friendship and to exchange marriage partners and to meet your siblings' kids and all these things. So we know, looking at modern pastoralists, that ancient pastoralists must have had the same kind of structures that kept them alive. This is also a security network. If something happens in your area, there's a bad drought, there's a livestock epidemic, something happens and a bunch of your animals die, these social relationships among humans are absolutely crucial for making sure that you survive the next year. Your family members will help you by giving you some animals. You can lean on the social network that you've built to make sure you survive. And this is really what keeps pastoralists living in these semi-arid, unpredictable landscapes, that they have these human social networks, these communities of people who can bail them out when times get tough. And then further down the road, they will help someone else who's in times of need. This is absolutely crucial. And we know this from years and years and years of ethnographic work among pastoralists. But if you think about it, when people were coming into this area with livestock for the first time, they wouldn't have had any of those networks. They wouldn't have known anybody. They wouldn't have known the landscape very well. They wouldn't have even necessarily had access to certain parts of the landscape, if there were already people living there, they would have had to make friends and make allies. And in addition to that, they would have needed to have a place where they could all come together with the people that they already knew, but potentially new people as well, to kind of solidify those bonds, do those things that we mentioned, exchanging gifts, exchanging animals, exchanging friendships and marriage partners. And they would have really needed a place to do that. And that's challenging on a mobile landscape where people are moving around a lot. And so just like you said, what we think these pillar sites were these early on ideas to kind of create this monument on the landscape that would trigger people's feelings of community. And it would kind of be a landmark that would call people to this area every now and again. And we think this for a few reasons. Number one, these are really the only permanent places on this landscape that we found. Number two, they built them up. So in other places, for example, along the Nile Valley, you'll find these jebels, these big mountains that people will create cemeteries on and have ritual sites on, because they're these kind of looming landmarks that people can see for miles away. Now, Lothagam North, the paper or the site we talk about in this paper, is very much on the same kind of hill. It's on this hill called Lothagam. It's a very famous fossil locality for those of you who are into those kind of things. But what do you know? This big hill sticking out of the Turkana Desert also really attracted people in the Holocene 5,000 years ago. So I can tell you from personal experience over many years that hiking up that hill is a lot of work, particularly with the total station strapped to your back. So it takes a little bit of effort to get up there. And then it would have taken huge effort to create this site, digging out that huge cavity, burying these people, dragging pillars across Lothagam's ridge to put in the site. And so people not only found this kind of landmark that already existed naturally, but they built up this landmark more to create this place where people could come together to kind of participate in these community activities. And so the effect of it is truly monumental in terms of these monuments are to their community by their community. And we think that's why those sites were built. In terms of why they're a cemetery, it's hard to get into the minds of people 5,000 years ago. But again, thinking about modern examples, thinking about our essence of humanity and the way that we interact with one another, burying your people together is a pretty powerful statement. It suggests you and I are the same because our ancestors are in the same place. And these are places where we can go together and we can remember how we're linked and how we're a community together. So, you know, a bit of that is a little bit speculative. But I think in this situation where the landscape is changing, the economy is changing, and potentially there's a lot of social change as well, creating a permanent place, which is also a burial ground, is a good way to unite people together.
That's really interesting. I mean, especially when you're talking about the size of these, it sounds like there's a lot of sunk cost, a lot of labor involved. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I know people talk about in other parts of the world and in other time periods is kind of the social organization that goes along with the creation of these really labor-intensive sites. And it's often associated with sort of hierarchical structures. So, you know, there is an elite class that can organize people and say, okay, build this monument for me or for mm-hmm. us. Is there indications of that kind of social hierarchy or social structure in the site that you're finding?
Not only have we not found any strong indications of that, but we found some evidence to the contrary, which is one thing I know the media really picked up on, this non-hierarchical cemetery. But one thing that we found so interesting was that everybody is buried so densely together. And based on our excavations, although we've been conservative, of course, not to disturb too much of the site, what we're seeing is this equality among people buried within the site. Everyone has slightly different ornamentation. It's very idiosyncratic. Some people have blue beads, some people have red beads, those kind of things. But there's no big indication that there's a wealthy area of the cemetery or that some people are more important than others. We also don't see big changes in terms of sex and age of the skeletons. The babies are right in there with the grandmothers and grandfathers. The women and the men are together. Everybody is really closely and densely buried, tucked up right against each other, which is not a clear indication that these are somehow the elites. The other thing that's so interesting is that we would have assumed that population densities were pretty low during this time, especially with mobile herders. And so one way to get this many bodies in that cavity would really be to prioritize burying most of the people there together at those sites. So it doesn't really look like this is, you know, one cemetery for some people and then there's other cemeteries for others. It really seems that Lothagam North especially, and there are interesting indications coming from the five other pillar sites as well, that these are really places that were used as community burial grounds. So we find that especially interesting considering that these are monumental sites, because many of the other examples that we have of monumentality either come from, like you said, a hierarchical society where one pharaoh is saying, build me a pyramid, or they arise in situations with horticulturalists or hunter-gatherers or farmers where you have a sedentary society in a predictable landscape. And this predictable resource-rich landscape allows people to have surpluses, which allow them to branch out into different aspects of the society. Maybe you have some artisans, maybe you have some farmers, some herders, some laborers, but you have this kind of stratification. And we don't really see that among these highly mobile herders in this very unpredictable landscape. So this is really an example of monumentality that kind of challenges our historic interpretations of who builds monuments. Instead of having these people build the monuments to the place where they're living for generations and generations in one spot, you're having these people build monuments at the very beginning in order to draw people to these places for generations to come, almost as a trigger for a community as opposed to a monument to that community.
That's absolutely fascinating. So one of the things that I kind of caught and I'm intrigued by is, so we have this pretty mobile population, they're pastoralists. But then it sounds like people are either bringing bodies back to be buried at these sites or bringing people who are potentially ill or in the process of becoming deceased back to these sites. I mean, is that sort of what you see happening or thinking it's happening? They're sort of curating in some ways bodies to bring back to these burial sites, or?
So that's a good logistics question and one that we've thought a lot as well about, because of course the Turkana Desert today reaches almost 40 degrees Celsius in the midday. It's very hot. And of course humans are made of meat, and this is a problem that all societies must grapple with. And so very often it seems that people could not be transported to the site before they would begin to decompose. And so the way that we know this is what's happening is we see two types of burials at the site, again, all in the various orientations and positions, but we see primary burials, which indicates that those people were buried very soon after they died when they still had their skin and their hair and these elements. And we know this because the skeletons are still in articulation. So it looks like they decomposed in that spot. There are other burials at the site, which are called secondary burials. And actually, this is something that's taken directly from North American and USA archaeology. These bundles of long bones and other elements of someone who was buried somebody else or somewhere else and decomposed there. And that place was remembered. And later on, people went to go retrieve either elements of that person or the whole person and bring them back and bury them in a bundle on the site. So they were still included after the fact. So it was probably a combination of, as you said, people just being in the right place in the right time to make sure that their family members were interred right away. But also for the people who were too far, the monthly cycle was too far away from the site at that time or whatever else the situation was, there was this contingency plan to make sure they could still be included with the rest of the people at the site.
That leads me to another question here about the use of the site. You know, even if depending, it doesn't matter what the range is that you think it was used for, from 400 years to even 1,000 years or even 2,000 years, it was 5,000 years ago, give or take. So since people have lived in that area for, well, I mean, Homo sapiens have lived in that area for 200,000 years. I don't know how long they've been burying people, but since people have lived in that area and continue to live in that area, it's logical to assume that if that site was either full or for some reason they decided to stop using it, that there must be other similar things around, especially if that knowledge was held onto for a minimum of 400 to 500 years mm-hmm. about this is how we bury people, or this is where we do it. Are there other similar sites in the area, or are you looking at this for clues to how to find those other sites in the area, you know, with similar similar clues?
So we do know from our research, not only at Lothagam North, but at three other pillar sites, and then there's an additional two that have some preliminary excavations, that the total amount of time for the pillar sites was no more than about 1,000 years. All six pillar sites mm-hmm. around the lake kind of ceased to be used around 4,200 years ago. And it's not because people leave the basin. In fact, we still see archaeology after that. But the indications are at that point, the lake has settled down at about today's modern lake level. Pastoralism at this point is established. The environment has calmed down. And for whatever reason, people just don't feel the need to necessarily make pillar sites anymore. Like I mentioned, they weren't abandoned quickly. They were finished in an orderly fashion, including dragging those heavy pillars, which is also really interesting to think about, that the people who envisioned the site and the people who added pillars at the end potentially were hundreds of years apart, but, you know, came together to create these things. And in terms of where they went, I mean, that really still remains a question. Did those particular cultural people move further south? We do know that pastoralism from the Turkana Basin spread to the South Central Rift Valley of southern Kenya and northern Tanzania, but there's about an 800-year lag that we continue to grapple with. We don't know if it's because there were different disease challenges moving from there, if there were social or environmental reasons why it was hard to leave the Turkana Basin and go into southern Kenya. But after about 800 years, pastoralism really takes off in South Central Kenya, and we see the explosion of the pastoral Neolithic that has many cultures and many sites in which we can see that there's 99% cattle at those sites. People are really invested in pastoralism. So maybe the pillar site people went on to, you know, bring pastoralism to the rest of Kenya and Tanzania, and some people stayed behind. The other thing is potentially just the culture changed. So after that period, all throughout the pillar sites, we see pretty consistent material culture in terms of what kind of stone tools they're using, the kind of pottery styles they're using. But after that period, we see kind of divergence in the Turkana Basin. There's different types of pottery and ceramics that are coming into use. People obviously aren't making pillar sites anymore. And then to answer your question about where the burials are, we see the rise of a new form of cemetery, which are cairn fields. So instead of building everybody in one big central cavity, what we see are landscapes dotted with these individual cairns, sometimes dozens of them. We don't have pillars associated with them necessarily, in one case potentially. We see the arrival of rock art. We don't know at this point if these are new people coming into the area, if they're the same people that are just continuing to evolve culturally, or if it's some combination thereof. But that's really an area for future research, because the mysterious cairn fields of the Turkana Basin have not been systematically studied to this point. There's some really interesting preliminary research, but that's an area for sure for expansion, understanding what changed and what changed in terms of how people were burying their dead.
Okay. And with that, we will leave segment two and take a short break and be back in a second.
Hey, podcast fans and digital archaeologists. Have you heard about WildNote? It's a data collection app that works online or offline on your smartphone or tablet, iOS or Android. It allows you to collect field data easily, manage data efficiently, and generate data reports and site records effortlessly. We have a growing list of state site forms built in for your use and some generic forms that will work anywhere. Check out the shovel testing and photograph forms. You can get a free all-access 30-day trial today by going to wildnoteapp.com. That's wildnoteapp.com for your free 30-day trial. Now back to the show.
All right, welcome back to episode 49. And when we left off the last segment, you were talking about change. And a few of the things you said during the last segment were talking about the lake, Lake Turkana, and you know, things going on there at the time. Can you speak a little more, I guess, deliberately, to, for lack of a better word, about the Lake Turkana environment 5,000 years ago and how different that was from what it looks like today? Because I think you mentioned it was settling down. I mean, the whole world was kind of settling down 5,000 to 8,000 years ago from the last major ice age. How was that area, which, you know, may or may not have been affected as much as, say, Europe by that time period. But how is that area different than it is today?
So the pillar sites are constructed right at the end of this period of major global climate change called the African Humid Period, which the dates are, they kind of vary, but they're about 12,000 years ago to about 6,000 years ago. There was this period which for a variety of orbital and other factors created a much wetter Sahara than we have in the present day. So this is called the Green Sahara, if you've come across that kind of literature. And during that time, there were more lakes, there were more rivers. is a lot more savanna grasslands. And this is really where pastoralism arrived in Africa. This is the birth of food production in Africa, these pastoralists moving around this green Sahara. Around 6,000 years ago, all good things must come to an end. And there is this period of global climate change, which we call the termination of the African Humid Period, or AHP. And this causes the desert to start to expand and dry out. And this, of course, pushes these pastoralists out into the Nile Valley, west into the Sahel, and then east into southeast into the Turkana Basin, which is the origins of pastoralism in Eastern Africa. And that's what these sites date to, that incredibly interesting time. So the local effects of the termination of the AHP in the Turkana Basin was the shrinkage of the lake. So the lake went from much larger than it is today to about 50% of its its current volume. But it wasn't kind of a straight road to that. Between about 10,000 years and 5,000 years ago, and there's a lot of geological publications on this, the lake was really oscillating. It was going up, it was going down. There were kind of periods of overflow into other catchment basins. And it was a very wet environment, but also a very unpredictable environment. And during this time, you can see these fisher foragers living around the lake. There was a very kind of media-rich paper in Nature in 2015 by Marta Lahr and colleagues about the Naturuk site in the southwest area of the Turkana Basin about 10,000 years ago. And it was the earliest indications of warfare and violence, because she found this absolutely amazing site where, unfortunately, people were brutally killed. And it kind of started this conversation about how these fisher foragers are using this unpredictable lake resource, what's happening in the early Holocene to create these kind of violent interactions, and is it tied to the environmental situation at the time? And this kind of informs a lot of what we're doing with the pillar sites in a really interesting way. So we know that the pillar sites, when they're created, the lake is dropping at that point. And as I mentioned, this is really changing the circumstances for those fisher foragers living around the lake. Herders are coming in. They're not quite sure what to do with the lake, not quite sure what to do necessarily with the environment. And instead of seeing that violence in the early Holocene during those lake fluctuations, what we instead see is people coming together to build huge cemeteries. So it's almost a completely different approach to dealing with a stressful time period, and one that's really interesting for us to look at when we consider the effects of climate change around the world in the past and now. There's always a tendency for many archaeologists and other researchers to look at the environment in terms of change quite fatalistically, an environmentally kind of deterministic way of understanding human responses to climate change. And of course, that's a major topic in our society right now, how we're dealing with climate change, what the situation is with people who no longer can live the way that they were living or can no longer live in the place that they were living because of this climate change. And this is an incredibly germane conversation to Turkana today, which is one of the hardest hit areas in Eastern Africa in terms of global warming. This is causing multi-year droughts, a lot of conflict and a lot of humanitarian suffering among pastoralists living in that area. And it's a major conversation about, can people continue to be pastoralists after the environment has changed? Can people continue living their way of life in drought, in areas that have become very prone to erosion, very prone to interpersonal conflict because of this escalating climate change? And I think in that sense, actually looking 5,000 years ago is a really important lesson for us, because pastoralism came into Eastern Africa through the Turkana Basin during a similar time period of major environmental change. The birth of East African pastoralism is in a similar context to some of the challenges that pastoralists living in the same area are facing today. And so this is actually kind of a deep time lesson for us, understanding how pastoralist strategies work to promote survival and resilience during these tough times, how humans can come together during times of environmental change as opposed to turning on one another, and also how we regard strategies like pastoralism and other ways of traditionally living and their right to kind of continue doing those things on those landscapes, even during times when the environment is challenging. And so in that sense, it's really interesting to look at how people reacted 5,000 years ago to this major environmental change and how people are reacting today.
So the article, to go back to the CNN article anyway, the title indicates that it was this burial monument was unearthed recently. How long have you been working on this? Was it actually just discovered this year and then picked up by the news organizations?
It's been a work in progress, as I'm sure many archaeological projects are. Site was originally identified in the 1980s through survey, but it had never been excavated before. But in general, we've known about pillar sites in the Turkana Basin since about the 1960s, 70s. Archaeologists have known. Of course, as I mentioned, the Turkana people have known about them for much longer. it's a bit funny to call them discoveries. But our research with our team, the later prehistory of West Turkana, started in 2009 with my co-directors, Kate Grillo and Lisa Hildebrand, doing some preliminary excavations at the site. And during that time, they came across some things that looked like human remains. So they reburied them, and they called up my doctoral advisor, Susan Pfeiffer, who was about to accept me as her PhD student that fall. And so she called me up and said, she's a specialist in bioarchaeology or the study of human remains. So she called me up and she said, do you want to do some field work before you start your PhD and come to Kenya with me? And so when we got to Kenya, the two of us began excavating the site together with the rest of the team. And that's when we started finding the very, very, very dense burials, completely not what we were expecting. And so from there, we excavated at the site kind of with a full bioarchaeological approach, 2012, 2013, and 2014. And we also did ground penetrating radar during that period and kind of collected the data. And then it's been a few years to finally write up this publication because we had so much data to work with. But it's about been a work in progress for 10 years.
So when I was in Tanzania, I guess it's 2005 or so, I was at the Olduvai Gorge. We were staying at the Leakey Camp, and there was a Maasai camp really near to us that we went to and visited a couple times. And I mean, they were living like I imagine they have lived for quite some time. They had their children out there herding goats, and then the adults with their cattle and things like that. So living that lifestyle that they lived for a really long time. And something you just mentioned to me, the Turkana people, you said, knew of course about these things, and so there are still current Turkana people living a really relatively similar lifestyle in that area. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. And in fact, they're very involved in our research. So we've been bringing high school students and early university students from the local area into our digs and working with them every year. We also have three long-term research assistants from a local village called Kerio that's right by Lothagum. And they've been working with us and now are absolute experts in terms of excavating these kind of sites. And then in terms of that, we've also been working with the National Museums of Kenya as well to make sure that we not only respect the local communities, but also respect Kenyan heritage when we work with these sites, which are, of course, both archaeological, but because of their place in Turkana history and Turkana folklore, they're also cultural heritage sites that we really need to respect and work with local communities. But this is all to say that we actually have lots of contact with the local Turkana communities. They come up and visit the site. We routinely see kids on Lothagum Hill, and they are very much living a similar lifestyle. There are, of course, settled villages now in Turkana. Those are areas where there's schoolhouses, there's churches, there's medical facilities, there's vaccination stops, those kind of things. But you will definitely see still kids out herding their animals on Lothagum Hill, regarding us with great curiosity as we do this kind of work. And we are working with these communities to make sure, too, that this research can benefit their way of life as well in terms of enriching the cultural heritage of the area and also working with people on these sites. But I do want to conclude by saying that this is a very poor area, and they've had a tough time the last few years with the drought as well. And so working in this area also raises a lot of issues and a lot of interest for us about how we can use archaeology and how we can do archaeology in a way that not only intellectually benefits local communities, but also can create some real good. And that's a conversation of archaeology that needs to continue going forward about how we can do work in areas where populations are struggling with climate change and are very marginalized in a way that can raise the profile of an area and lead to some actual change and improvements in those areas.
Indeed. And I guess the thing that I'm really thinking about, primarily because I'm a cultural resource management archaeologist here in the United States, and I work with Native American communities a lot when we do our projects. And if any sort of cemetery or burial project is found, it's a really big undertaking because of the consultation that we have to have with the Native Americans and that we should have. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, what do the local Turkana people think about these? I mean, do they recognize them as ancestors? Do they, how do they feel about you digging up their ancestors, to be blunt about it?
No, that's an incredibly important question. We also engage in consultation. There is no overarching legislation in Kenya that is equivalent to NAGPRA, which is, I think, what you're talking about in terms of required consultation. And so that kind of creates a bit of a void in terms of what exactly projects are supposed to do. But the way that our project deals with it, with support from the National Museums of Kenya, is, of course, we have an NMK, a National Museums of Kenya policy officer with us at all times doing the excavations and working with local communities. And we also do our own kind of informal and formal consultations ahead of time at village meetings. They're called barazas in the local language. And you get there, you talk about what you're doing, you hire some people, you talk about your goals for that field season, and you report on the results of your previous field seasons. So that's something that we've been doing. In terms of if they regard these places as ancestors, the answer is no, they don't. Because in their own legend, they came from the G district of Uganda 300 years ago. So they consider themselves relatively recent migrants to the Turkana Basin, and these pillar sites were there when they arrived, which is why they regard them as the earlier people of the basin who were turned to stone. But they do have a name for them, Namuratunga, which means people of stone, and they absolutely regard themselves as guardian communities. This is their backyard. These are the sites that they care about. And so there has been quite a lot of conversation about what we're excavating, how we're excavating, why we're excavating, and how much we're excavating. So for Lothagum North, we've actually only excavated a relatively small portion of the site with highly targeted questions to understand how the site was built, how it accumulated, how the burials accumulated, those kind of questions. And then that's also why we use non-destructive technology such as ground-penetrating radar to get a sense of how big the cavity was and how many people could be buried there without having to disturb more than we absolutely needed to. And that's really our main concern going forward, to make sure that we can get the kind of archaeological answers that we're seeking with disturbing the fewest number of people who, of course, are interred in that site for a reason.
So to kind of begin our wrap up, since we're running out of time, unfortunately, what are moving forward? You know, it sounds like you've been collecting data for a few years now. What are kind of the next steps? Is it working in the lab and kind of really doing analyses to understand who these people were and different diseases and lifestyle components? Is it investigating other sites or spending more time at this particular one? Like, what are you seeing as the future for the next couple of years?
The big question that really remains that we haven't been able to answer is, why are there pillar sites on both sides of the lake? So if we think about livestock coming into the area, probably with a few scattered bands of people and kind of these small trickling motions, did people come around both sides of the lake? Did events on one side of the lake catalyze the creation of other pillar sites around the lake? And really, the way to approach this question most directly is to look at the two earliest and largest pillar sites, which are on opposite shores. There's Lothagum North that we just published on, and we have a bunch of data now that we continue to process for publication very soon. The sister site of Lothagum North is a site on the east side called Jerigole, that's just south of Sibiloy National Park. Today, the two sites are separated by 300 kilometers by land and over 150 kilometers by water. And having personally done the boat trip across Lake Turkana, it's a little bit terrifying. And I can't imagine moving goats on a boat would have been very easy. But we know from some, that's going to be the grant title, just watch. We know
it
from
sounds like a doctor's.
We know from preliminary excavations there in the 1980s and 90s, the material was never really published, but we were able to get some radiocarbon dates off, again, those ostrich eggshell beads that were stored at the National Museums of Kenya. And what's amazing is that Lothagum North and Jerigole overlap chronologically, which means they were constructed right around the same time, which it just creates a whole bunch of questions. Were these the same cultural group? Were they the same biological population? Were people moving back and forth across the Turkana Basin? Or was there kind of a more nuanced coming together of foragers and herders and people kind of dealing with these environmental and economic and social changes around different points of the lake where they were kind of in contact with one another, but maybe not, they were maybe cells of the same or villages of the same kind of culture in kind of a more dispersed way. So that's really the big question that we want to figure out. We now know from our excavations at Lothigam North that it's a humongous cemetery, the likes of which we've never seen before or after in the Turkana Basin. The next question is really, why are there six of them? And are there more? How are these sites used? Do they represent the same kind of cemetery? Do they represent the same kind of landmark of people coming together? Or do they have these auxiliary functions, which kind of changes the story about how people are dealing with this climate change and this economic change at different points in the frontier? So that's the next major excavation that we're planning, hopefully for the coming summer or shortly thereafter. And really what will be so important with those excavations is that we're going to be able to look at kind of three aspects of cultural and biological integration. One, the actual skeletons that are buried there, assuming we'll find some, and we have good indication that we will, comparing the skeletal biology and other kind of biological aspects between the two sites. Two, looking at the architecture, was the same giant cavity dug out? You know, did people have this plan from the outset? And then thirdly, of course, the material culture. Are people using the same kind of artifacts, the same kind of tools? Is there any indication of trade between the sites? And how are these people kind of interfacing with this time of major change at various points along this frontier?
Okay. That should only take like a field season. So good luck with
it. It's a work in progress. We've got some pretty targeted hypotheses to start off with.
Nice. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Dr. Sacek, about talking to us about this. It's fascinating. I don't get to hear enough about like Africa and that whole area on these podcasts. So I'm glad we could bring that in and learn some stuff about it. So we will have links to this and to the article we found and some other things in the show notes. So check that out. And in the meantime, check out our back catalog as well. And if you have any questions, please send them on through the website or wherever you found this. All right. Thank you, Elizabeth. And thank you, April.
Yeah, it was great being here and getting to talk to you today.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email Chris at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song, I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks. And in the meantime, keep learning. Keep discovering new things and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day. This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in Reno, Nevada at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.